Hey, good afternoon, Juneau. It's just seconds before, well, it is exactly 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore is going to be your host today for Juneau Afternoon, and I've got a great lineup of guests today. Up on campus, we're going to be talking with Bill Morrison, who's here in town as part of the week-long Alaska-Canada Relations Fall Symposium that's been held by the Juneau World Affairs Council up in cooperation with UAS. Morrison's written a book some years ago with Ken Coates called The Thinking of the Princess Sophia, and we're going to be talking about that book, which he's presenting some information on tonight at a special session at 7 o'clock at UAS. Cooking classes at Shea, Alaska are back, and they'll be here to talk about those. The Aware Self-Defense class for women is coming up this weekend. And When You See Flukes, a new book out by none other than Kathy Hawker. She'll be here to tell us all about that. So that lineup of guests right with me here coming up on Juneau Afternoon. Right now it's time for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal, state, federal, and mining company staff recently toured a proposed iron ore mine site in northern Wisconsin. As Mike Simonson reports, it was the first time tribal officials were invited.
Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Waste Management Director Ann Coakley says they took a five-hour hike with the major players in the proposed mine, including Bad River Tribal Environmental Scientists.
They are downstream of what could be a potential mine, and they do have their own water quality standards. And whatever we review and ultimately either approve or deny, if we were to approve it, it would have to meet those tribal water quality standards. So we certainly want to coordinate with the tribe in that regard.
Bad River Environmental Specialist Cyrus Hester says the field trip of old U.S. steel rock sampling sites in Iron and Ashland counties is a good first step.
I think this is the state recognizing that just as there's a need to collaborate with federal regulators, that tribal regulators need to be included as well, because they will play a role in the review and the planning of this proposed project.
Hester hopes this means the days of being excluded from environmental inspection trips are behind them.
We'll see how it plays out. This can be a long, long story.
The tribes have contended that 19th century treaties give them the right to protect the ceded territory so they can hunt, fish, and gather there. For National Native News, I'm Mike Simonson.
A herd of genetically pure bison is roaming the plains of a northern Montana reservation for the first time since being nearly hunted to extinction in the 1800s. The animals come from Yellowstone National Park. Tribes on the Fort Belknap Reservation have hailed their arrival, but those living closest to the herd are voicing concerns. Montana Public Radio's Dan Boyce reports.
Fort Belknap Fish and Wildlife Program Director Mark Azure stands in a 1,000-acre pasture of dry grassland. He's looking at about 24 bison gathering around a watering hole.
Grazing, you know, wallowing, drinking, checking us out.
He says the tribes have been working for this for years.
This is their home. This is where they came from.
The reservation received the 34 animals through a deal with Montana wildlife officials. But next-door rancher and tribal member Lita Calvin is not happy.
People find out that we have the cattle here and the bison are next to them. People are going to be less apt to buy our calves.
Because of the disease brucellosis, it runs in bison and can cause cattle to abort their calves. It could pretty much ruin a rancher's business. These bison, though, they've been tested over and over again for years. They do not have brucellosis. Calvin says it doesn't matter. It's the perception.
People around, they're not going to listen to all that.
Other surrounding landowners worry the bison will break out of their pasture, damaging private property, eating hay. But part of the deal the reservation cut with the state is if the state determines the tribes are not taking good enough care of the bison, they can be taken away. Reservation officials say they won't let that happen. State Representative Clarina Brockie says having genetically pure bison back on the landscape is significant for her tribe.
These are the same bison that were with my ancestors that helped my grandparents and my ancestors survive. These are the same bison.
The tribes and the state will be letting the herd grow over the next few years. Then the reservation will have full authority to decide whether to sell the bison for meat or use them for ceremonial purposes. For National Native News, I'm Dan Boyce in Helena, Montana.
Members of the National Congress of American Indians picked their new leader Thursday. Brian Cladesby, chairman of the Swinomish tribe, was elected president of the organization at its annual convention in Oklahoma. Two-term president Jefferson Keel steps down today. In October 2011, University of Manitoba President David Barnard apologized for Canada's Indian residential schools. He said while post-secondary institutions did not fund or operate the schools, the university failed to recognize and challenge the residential school system, where many students were abused. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's just almost 6 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. All week long, there has been a symposium going on up on the University of Alaska Southeast Campus. As the Juneau World Affairs Council here, JWAC, has been cooperating with UAS to put together a symposium this year on Canada. This is an annual event at UAS, but this is the first time I know of that they focused on Canada. And the guest of honor and person who I think spoke at easily half of the events that occurred up there was Bill Morrison, who's joining us here from the UAS campus online. Bill, welcome aboard.
Thank you very much.
So Bill is, you're an emeritus faculty from Toronto, right?
No, I'm an emeritus faculty from the University of Northern British Columbia,
NBC.
Prince George.
Yeah, okay, good. And several years ago, you and Ken Coates cooperated to write a book on the sinking of the Princess Sophia, Taking the North Down with Her. And I understand tonight you're going to be giving a presentation as the Egan Evening at Egan presentation that ties into the seminar that's been going on all week where you're going to talk about the sinking of the Sophia.
Yes, indeed.
So this is quite an amazingly encyclopedic work. I think using the passenger list, you were able to collect family information on a very large number of the people who were actually aboard the Sophia and who died in the accident. So this is sort of a salute to them and a remembrance of them. But you also had a kind of a concern that somehow the Sophia got lost in the 1918 post-World War I celebration, and that its true importance to the North was never fully recognized. Is that a fair summary?
Yes, that's right. And the reason it was forgotten, I guess there are two reasons. One is that the timing was incredibly bad for publicity purposes. I mean, the Titanic sank in 1912 when there wasn't much else going on and it was full of rich people. The Princess Sophia sank, and when they finally brought the bodies down from Juneau, where they'd been brought to be cleaned up and sort of made presentable looking, and they shipped them down to Vancouver, and the ship, which the papers called the Ship of Death, arrived in Vancouver Harbor on the morning of the 11th of November 1918, which was Armistice Day, and everybody in town, instead of being sad, was dancing in the streets and cheering. So the ship had to stay offshore for a day and then come in on the 12th to unload all these corpses in a makeshift morgue. I mean, talk about bad timing. And the other thing was, of course, that the North was so marginalized by that time in sort of public perception and discourse that, first of all, only the relatives cared very much, or people who cared about maritime history, and secondly, the North emptied out so much that there was hardly anybody there who remembered it, which is why there wasn't a memorial in Dawson City until 2001.
I want to return briefly to the statement you made about the North being kind of fading away. The subtitle of your book is Taking the North Down with Her, and I wonder if you could expand on what you and your co-author were thinking about when you added that as a subtitle.
Well, we like to think, when you realize that the number of people died represented 8 to 10% of the non-Indigenous population of the Yukon, I mean, that's a tremendous loss of people. And, for instance, Captain Alexander of the Engineer Mine near Atlin was on the ship and was traveling out to raise some money to open the mine. Well, he went down on the ship, nobody was interested in the mine, and it never did open. So theirs were jobs lost. A city councilor, the people who left and who died were sort of irreplaceable. Nobody filled the holes up, and the population of the Yukon in particular continued to shrink. That's what we meant by taking the North down with her.
There was a secondary meaning to this as well, though, because many of the passengers who were aboard the Sophia were people who were leaving Alaska for the season, although some of them may have been actually leaving forever. But it was very common, which I found quite a startling fact, because I know that we now have a snowbird population in Alaska, but it never occurred to me that in 1918 there was a snowbird population throughout the Yukon and throughout the North.
You know, it never occurred to us either, and we were equally startled when we got these histories and found out that people said, well, my husband had gone up to Fairbanks or Tanana or wherever, or Dawson, every year since 1905, but in fact he'd never spent a winter there, because by the 20th century, the gold mining in the Yukon was all dredging, and they didn't work and operate in the winter. So that as soon as the freeze-up came, the dredges shut down, everybody jumped on the steamboats. The steamboats went up to Whitehorse, where they were pulled out of the water for the winter, and the whole place shut down. So there was nothing to do there from November till May. And people, we found people who said, yes, I'm a Northerner, I'm a Yukoner, I'm an Alaskan. But they had, in fact, in 15 years or so, never spent a winter there.
And so then once they arrived at Whitehorse, this group of people, typical of the time, would have then taken the White Pass and Yukon Railway down to Skagway.
That's right.
And probably boarded one of the Canadian Pacific ships down there, such as the Princess Sophia.
And because it was so late in the season, it was freeze-up, they put on extra berths and extra bunks. They weren't illegally overloaded, but they were full, and there were 354 passengers and crew leaving to get out before the freeze-up, which would simply close the place down for the winter.
It's an interesting thought. 354 passengers and crew. This summer, we had a number of boats arrive in Seward in Juneau for the day with about 2,800 people on them. So,
yeah, enormous things. And let us hope that none of those ever run onto a rock.
Let us hope. So the rock in this case was Vanderbilt Reef, out in the middle of Lynn Canal, in a place where it should have been completely avoidable and probably, well, would have been completely avoidable had they had radar.
Yes.
Or any of the other modern...
Well, had it been marked by a lighted buoy, but in 1918,
yeah,
it had a kind of floating can buoy painted red tied to one end of the reef or anchored at one end of the reef. And you can see it during the daylight in a flat calm, but you sure can't see it at night or in a storm.
And so the captain and his mate, to ensure that they weren't going to be going down the middle of Lynn Canal, but instead staying off to the starboard side where they were supposed to be, am I correct, starboard?
I don't remember.
I think they're supposed to stay to the right of the rock anyway. But as they came down, they may have taken a wrong reading on the one spot that they were supposed to get a compass
That's
reading
right.
off of.
That's right.
And that would have been enough error to have put them right astride the rock,
and
which
you
is
know,
exactly what happened.
I found out how they navigated down the Lynn Canal, and I am not going to tell your readers or your listeners. If they want to find out, they'll have to come. But the thing is, that I actually,
no spoiler, huh?
When we wrote the book, I actually interviewed a man who had been on the crew of the boat of the ship during an earlier voyage, a 95-year-old man who was still alive, who'd been the purser on the Sophia in 1916, and I found out how they navigated from talking to him.
Yeah, and you do talk about it, I think, in the book, and it is a fascinating process. But I will no more give it away than you will.
Thank you,
Bill. You're on at 7 o'clock tonight, I think, in the big lecture hall.
Yes, I am.
And I'm assuming with pictures and all like that.
Yeah, with pictures. Although my guess is that many people in Juneau have seen those pictures because they were taken by a photographer from Juneau who came up on a fishing boat and took pictures, brought them back and sold them and made postcards of them. And when we did our research 25 years ago, people sent us the postcards that said, oh, yeah, my father had this, and you'd probably like to see it. So they were very widely circulated. I imagine a lot of people here have seen them.
So, Bill, do you plan to come back and join us here in Juneau in 2018 for the undoubted rememberings?
Are you going to have a centennial celebration? That would be great.
Well, I heard some talk about that as a possibility
on
Wednesday's show on here when we were interviewing the folks who were putting
And it would be just at this time of the year because it happened 95 years ago this week.
Well, maybe you should volunteer to be the chair of the remembrance and put this together.
I'd certainly be a guest.
Okay, good enough. Bill Morrison, thank you so much. Talking tonight at 7 o'clock in the Egan Lecture Hall up on the University of Alaska campus. Going to give us some more details and give away tonight the secret of how they navigated down Lynn Canal at the turn of the century, or just after the turn of the century when the Sophia went down in October of 1918. Thank you so much for coming
on
and telling
much.
Us about your talk.
Thank you.
Bye now.
This is Bird Note. As a red-tailed hawk soars high above the earth, its searing call pierces the air. From its lofty outlook, the hawk commands what idiom calls a bird's-eye view. The Oxford English Dictionary dates the phrase back to the 1760s and defines it as a view of a landscape from above, such as is presented to the eye of a bird. Well, just how well does a bird see? Scientists have found great variation among the eyes of different birds, and debate continues about birds' visual acuity, that is, about the sharpness of their vision. But we do know that visual acuity is keenest among birds like flycatchers and hawks, which must pick out very small or distant moving objects. One often repeated speculation had hawks' vision as 8 times more acute than humans. Now, this is now known to be an exaggeration. Their eyes are more likely 3 times sharper than ours. But just imagine seeing 3 times as well as you do now. Such visual ability would be nothing short of brilliant. And the vision of hawks remains, as one expert writes, probably the most highly developed eyesight that exists. Would you like to receive stunning photos each week of the birds we'll feature in the week ahead? Come to birdnote.org and sign up on the link entitled Weekly Preview. For BirdNote, I'm Frank Corrado.
Support for this program comes from Balloons by Night Moods, offering photo booth prop boxes for your next event. Prop boxes include masks, glasses, feather boas, and other accessories. More information at 523-1099.
Hi, my name is Phil Paramore. I am the recreation manager at the University of Alaska Southeast. I like public radio because it's fresh, it's current, and I love the variety.
If you're like Phil, please go to k2.org to begin or renew your membership during our quiet drive. To hear the showy DJs, tune in to KRNN on Monday mornings from 8 to 10 for an eclectic mix of jazz and blues.
by Thomas Michaud, entitled, it's off an album called Beauty and Fire. And I kind of like his stuff. That's called Embrace in the Mist. Very nice little quiet sound to usher in the fact that we're going to be talking about something a little less quiet. There's a class coming up, a very special class, starting Saturday morning. And Diana Stevens, who is also known around town as Sensei Diana, who is the sensei of the Shotokan Karate Dojo here in town, will be instructing ladies in self-defense at the, let's see, you're going to be at the...
Zach Gordon.
The Zach Gordon Youth Center, right. Diana is a fifth-degree black belt in Shotokan, which is a Japanese karate style. It's a very traditional, almost military style. Can you give us a kind of an idea of what women can expect when they meet with you at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning?
Sure. We start tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock at Zach Gordon Youth Center. And if you haven't registered, please come and you can register at the door, even though that's not what we're advertising. And for the first hour, Zarupa will be there from AWARE, and she will be giving a, she will talk for the first hour, and she's a very, very interesting woman. And it'll be about AWARE and anything else that Zarupa wants to expand out on. And then, we start from there, and then we start the actual physical part of the self-defense. Although, I talk a bit myself. And throughout the day, we will do things. We talk a lot about attitude and keeping yourself out of trouble and things that you can do to marginalize, to make sure that you don't get into trouble. That's the first thing about self-defense is not putting yourself in situations where you are in danger and getting out of situations that you are in, in various, maybe a relationship, whatever it is. So we talk quite a bit about safety precautions and so forth. But we do also do a myriad of self-defense movements, and we partner up and go over them and switch partners and go over them so that you have a variety of body styles and different, age, young versus old and so forth. So you get quite an eclectic view on how to handle yourself with various people.
I think two things that you mentioned. Attitude is really part of the key is an awareness and an attitude about that. We're led by the media to think that if you know something about self-defense, then you can walk into a bar and just pick a fight with the big guy in the corner. And that's not a good idea.
I wouldn't do it.
Right. So the really important thing, I think, is somebody once said that the best piece of karate equipment you can get is a good pair of running shoes.
Yeah,
so you can
great
get
advice.
Away.
You bet. You yeah. bet. I mean, I've been in karate for over 30 years, and I certainly have no – I use it every day, but I use it in my head. I mean, I think about it, and I walk a particular way, and I keep myself protected through the attitude that I project. And so that you are practicing a martial art in that way, but to go pick a fight or to stick around and I don't go to bars very much myself anyway, but when I did, I still used a wise attitude, and things started to get feeling a little odd or something, then you go find somewhere else to go and do something mm-hmm. that's a little safer.
I think that the second part of the awareness that needs to that is particularly critical about the class that you're teaching is that if you haven't thought about what you might do under dire circumstances, then essentially you have no defense at all. But if you've at least got a clue of something that you could do, then with a little practice, that might be the way out of something that you couldn't avoid.
Yes, yes. I do. I agree that I can't say that you don't have any. I mean, you never know what's going to come out of somebody's head when they're put in a dangerous situation. But to have practiced and to have thought about that and to have sometimes mentally put yourself in a situation and gotten yourself back out of it is very, very good practice. Because once, if something happens, you have no time to think. So you have no time to think about what your body might do or how you might how you might react to something. So the more you've taught your body to react in certain ways, then hopefully that instinct of what you've learned just takes over and you can make yourself safe and get away from the situation. And we talk about that a lot. Do not stay in a dangerous situation. Defend yourself and leave and get out.
You have some people come along to help you with the class.
I do. I have two people, Dolores O'Mara and Julie Bittinger. And so they will be for the entire class. It's a really fun, stimulating class. It's very basic. Over the years, we've taught people of sometimes with physical handicaps or age or arthritis, whatever it is, we figure out a way that you can benefit somehow through self-defense. And it's repetitious. We do maybe the same sort of thing from one attack to the next to the next, so that when you walk out, you've got a pretty good arsenal of what you could do in a situation.
The class starts at 9 o'clock. It's at Zach Gordon Youth Center. And is it for the whole day? Or?
It's from 9 o'clock till 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Four. People bring a bag lunch.
Bring a bag lunch, wear comfortable clothing, just something loose that you can move in. And then we take a couple breaks for water and so forth.
Now, assuming someone wanted to go further with this, you are the sensei of a dojo, which two Japanese words in one sentence, you have to explain what that means. But essentially, you're in charge of a facility where people can continue to train in the karate discipline. So how many people are actually part of the dojo?
You know, it's always, there's a lot of attrition in karate, but I would guess that there's probably registered about 40 of us at the moment, give or take.
If someone were interested in joining the dojo, how would they go about doing that?
They could come onto our website, junoshotokan.org, and they can get not only the registration form, but directions and so forth. They can call me at 907-723-6165. Or they can just drop by at 9447 La Perouse. We have karate from 6 to 8:30 on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and Saturdays from 10 to 11. So you can drop by and watch a class and check it out and see what you think.
Okay, 6:30 to 8, I think.
6:30 to 8.
Yeah.
Oh,
6:30 to 8. Yeah, old hours. I think we're 6:30. Yeah. Okay, so 6 to 6:30 to 8 on Tuesdays and Thursdays. People could just drop by and look
in
on the class.
Certainly, you can come in. It's a warehouse, and there's a sign above the door and a tiger emblem on the garage door, and you can just open the door, and we've got bleachers inside. So you're welcome to come in and just observe the class.
Now, this year, as I understand it, someone from the Juno Shotokan Dojo is going to compete in the national competition. What is that about? It's in Cincinnati, right?
That is correct. It's in Cincinnati.
Who's going?
Kiana Potter. Kiana is 10 years old, and we've been doing training for a couple months. Her and I have been meeting an hour or two outside of the dojo and going over her kata, which is her form, and her kumite, which is the fighting portion of it. And she's quite an exceptional young girl, a lot of very focused, very good attention span. And
won an award last August, I think.
Yes, she did. Yeah. She won an award at camp for being, we call it the Cheryl Phillips Award. And it's for people that, not really even thinking about it, just go above and beyond what is expected of them. I mean, you know, they're helpful. They're always there. They just contribute way more than the average person. And that was Kiana.
So Kiana will be going to Cincinnati to compete in November?
Yes, in November, I think around the 13th to the 15th, I believe, of November. And it's we're ISKF, and ISKF is International Shotokan Karate Federation, and that's who we're affiliated with. That's who we're part of. And so every year we have a nationals, and this year it's going to be in Cincinnati, and I go as a judge, but I probably won't be judging Kiana. It's a very big event. There are many, many hundreds of people there. And then, so we'll be going there in November. And then next year, we'll have our nationals here in Alaska. They'll be in Anchorage.
Oh.
So Anchorage hosts the nationals next year.
So the karatekas from all over the country will be
all
coming
over
to,
the United States.
Uh-huh, will be coming to Anchorage.
Come to this, yes.
Wow.
And we're all the same style. And, uh-huh. and many of us know each other for many years now.
Well, that's a wonderful thing. We'll have to have you back to talk a little bit about that get closer. That's a very big event for the state of Alaska. Okay, but the event of great importance right now is the Aware Self-Defense class for women beginning at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning at the Zach Gordon Youth Center. Three instructors, and you can handle pretty much as many people as
yes,
yeah,
yes.
Okay.
We've had sometimes 25 people. It's very structured, so it's not hard to, but, you know, you're going to put out some energy.
Okay, so
don't be afraid of that.
Loose clothing, bag lunch. Mm-hmm. There is a $10 fee, but as I understand it, there's a possibility of scholarships.
Yes.
So don't let the money keep you away.
Right.
And if this is of interest to you, you don't need to contact anyone. Just show up at Zach Gordon Youth Center at 9 o'clock, and we can register you right there at the
That's
door.
Correct.
I think.
Tomorrow morning.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you very, very much for coming and telling us all about this. And I wish you good luck, not only with the sessions tomorrow, but with the nationals that you'll be going to in November.
Great. Thank you so much, Pat.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 18th of October, 2013. It was on this day, 1954, the first transistor radio appeared on the market, the transistor taking the place of vacuum tubes that were unreliable, slow to warm up, fragile. Scientists at Bell Laboratories invented the first transistor technology in 1947. They were used mainly in military technology until Texas Instruments came along and wanted to put out a transistor radio. Radios were mostly big, bulky things, stayed in one place, usually in the living room, whole family gathered around to listen to them. And the transistor radio, Texas Instruments believed, would be small and portable and be a popular Christmas gift item. So they produced the Regency TR-1. It could fit in your pocket. It cost $49.95. More than 100,000 were sold. And then a Japanese company, Tokyo Tsushin Kogyo, decided to make transistor radios as well. They needed a name that Americans could pronounce, so they looked up the Latin word for sound, which was sonus. And they liked the term sunny boys, which was used by Japanese to refer to very bright young boys. And so the company Sony was born, and soon transistor radios were very cheap, and teenagers were able to afford them. And with transistor radios, they were able to listen to music out of their parents' earshot, which made possible the explosion of rock and roll. It's the birthday of the writer who said, "I can write better than anybody who can write faster, and I can write faster than anybody who can write better." A.J. Liebling, born New York, 1904. Dropped out of Dartmouth to become a newspaper reporter. He said, "I would pound up tenement stairs and burst in on families disarranged by sudden misfortune. It gave me a chance to make contact with people I would never otherwise have met. And I learned almost immediately what every reporter knows, that most people are eager to talk about their troubles." He joined the New Yorker magazine in 1935 and went on to write about France, about gourmet food, boxing, the press, and World War II. A collection of his work was published this year entitled Just Enough Liebling. It's the birthday of Entezaki Shange, born in Trenton, New Jersey, 1948, author of the play For Colored Girls Who Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough. And the novelist Terry McMillan, born Port Huron, Michigan, 1951, the best-selling African-American author in history. Terry McMillan, who said, "I don't write about victims. They just bore me to death. I prefer to write about somebody who can pick themselves back up and get on with their lives. Here's a poem for today by Jim Harrison, entitled The Bear. When my propane ran out, when I was gone, and the food thawed in the freezer, I grieved over the 5 pounds of melted squid. But then a big gaunt bear arrived and feasted on the garbage, a few tentacles left in the grass, purplish white worms. Oh, bear, now that you've tasted the ocean, I hope your dream life contains the whales I've seen, that one in the Humboldt Current basking on the surface, who seemed to watch the seabirds wheeling around her head. A poem by Jim Harrison, The Bear, from his collection Saving Daylight, published by Copper Canyon Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Produced by Joy Biles, with assistance by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 28 minutes to 4 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. With me in the studio are, two cooks. Well, one says that she's the chef, and the other says that he's not the chef. He doesn't do any of that kind of stuff. But anyway, Annie Humphreys and Jerry Spaulding are here. They're the owners of Shea Alaska, and we're going to hear in the next few minutes about a set of classes that are coming up and some other activities that Shea Alaska is involved in the area. Hi, folks.
Hi.
Good morning.
Yeah, welcome. Afternoon, actually, yeah. So tell me about this set of classes that you've got coming up.
Well, in the wintertime, we try every month to do at least two classes that are open to the public. We are always open to more suggestions for class titles. But coming up is Gifts in a Jar, and we're going to cover a lot of territory with that. It will be everything from baked goods in a jar, how to decorate them, label them, instructions to jarring up your own sauces that you might want to give for a gift. And then in November, we have two getting ready for Thanksgiving, the 9th. These classes run from 9 until 11 or 12, whichever, how much of our time we need to get through our information. And we'll be getting ready for Thanksgiving, and so we'll be doing chutneys, all kinds of things that we can make up ahead of time, savory butters, sweet butters, like apple and pumpkin butter, and we have a pretty large idea. I put a book together because there's so much information at these classes that you'll be able to take the book home and always refer to it.
And then you've got one on turkeys coming up on the 16th.
Yes. Yeah. Turkey 101. That will be three different ways to cook turkey without stuffing. And also we'll be going over many different types of stuffing. You'll get recipes for all of that. And we're actually going to cook a turkey and go through the whole process. And also gravy, good enough to drink.
Annie, where's your facility? Where do people go for the classes?
Jerry, you want to?
Jerry?
It's at the Nugget Mall, the Annex, right across from Lyle's.
Okay.
You can contact us at 789-0104.
Okay. And is there a limit on the number of people who can who me can handle in a class?
Well, 16 is a pretty good number.
Okay.
Of course, it depends on what we're doing. It's actually getting people to sign up ahead of time because I'm going to be giving them so much information. You can always reach me at Annie, A-N-N-I-E, at shealaska.com. We're in the process of rebuilding our website, so trying to find somebody to do it has always been a problem for us.
Are these real expensive classes?
No, and that's why we're trying to keep them reasonable. They're about 50% cheaper than the classes that we previously had. I'm trying to keep them at $50 a class. They were $99 before, and I just want to be able to get more people in and share the fun because we really have a good time doing these classes. And totally, we are so open and welcome to new class titles. They can email me also with and get on our email list. We do private parties. We're a great venue because of the size of our place for the smaller office parties. Christmas meetings, we have PowerPoint. Basically, any excuse for a gathering, we will get together and put our heads together and build a private party.
Now, you also are cooperating with REACH and another organization called HOPE and giving folks a chance to cook. And I think this is your primary interest, yeah, Jerry? Oh, both of you together?
Right. I pretty much teach all the classes, and Jerry...
Okay. I do the cleanup.
He really helps a lot. I mean, he does all of our paperwork and that. We also have another program with Johnson Youth Center. We have two chefs that we've hired. One of them is the culinary arts teacher at Thunder Mountain High School. And so we have a special program, and they and the other instructor is Felipe Oigoy, which he also works at the hospital. And so it gives the kids that qualify an opportunity to get out and cater the doctor's dinners once a month. And these people are really doing an amazing, amazing job with these kids.
We have people from Anchorage who came down now. They're trying to model our program, and they're taking them to different institutions outside the Juneau area to try to mimic what we're getting done with these programs. So it's really beneficial for us.
Before we open the mics up, you were telling a kind of a fun story about the folks that are taking the classes through REACH, that at first they were kind of reluctant about
it. Yeah,
they didn't want to come to this stuff and like that. And now it's a little different?
Oh, yeah. It's such a joy to be able to see this. I mean, we started with kids that are definitely raw. And these kids, our classes were starting at 10. We could barely get them there by 10:30 to even get classes started. Now between 9, 9:15, they're out there rattling their doors wanting to get in. I mean, these kids, and just the difference you've seen in their, you know, in their accomplishments. I mean, they're just different kids altogether. We've done well with them, and we're actually starting our second classes now with REACH. So we've done very well.
Well,
they've done well.
It sounds like a real deal. It makes me wish I was a doctor so I could get cooked for it.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so one more time, the classes that are coming up are October 29th, Gifts in a Jar. These are all
correct.
Saturday 9 to 12 in the annex on the end of the Nugget Mall.
The Nugget Mall.
Mall, right, okay.
It's called the Annex.
The Annex, okay. And then on November 9th, you're doing Chutneys and Spice Butters. And November 16th, Turkey 101, and it's Annie at ShayAlaska.com.
Correct.
If they want to pre-register for the class, and you do recommend that.
I hope to have everybody pre-register because I have gifts. I have a lot of things to give them, and I want to make sure that I have a proper amount.
Outstanding. Well, thank you so much for coming on and alerting us to the possibility of learning how to put a gift in a jar. And,
thank you.
Thank you.
You bet. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Ma chère mademoiselle, it is with deepest pride and greatest pleasure that we welcome you tonight. And now, we invite you to relax, let us pull up a chair, as the dining room proudly presents your dinner. Be our guest. Be our guest. Put our service to the test. Tie your napkin round your neck, sherry, and we provide the rest. Soup du jour, hot hors d'oeuvre. Why, we only live to serve. Try the gray stuff. It's delicious. Don't believe me? Ask the dishes. They can sing, they can dance. After all, miss, this is France. And a dinner here is never second best. Go on, unfold your menu, take a glance, and then you'll be our guest. We our guest, be our guest. Beef ragu, cheese souffle, I am pudding on flambé. We'll prepare and serve with flair a culinary cabaret. You're alone and you're scared, but the banquet's all prepared. No one's gloomy or complaining while the flatware's entertaining. We tell jokes, I do tricks with my fellow candlesticks.
Put it all in perfect taste that you can bear.
Come on and lift your glass, you've won your own free pass.
Be our guest.
If you're stressed, it's fine dining we suggest.
Be our guest. Be our guest. Be our guest.
Hey, it's 3:45, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. And my next guest, it's a wonderful honor to have her here because she is one of my favorite artists. And Kathy Hawker has a new book out called When You See Flukes. Kathy, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
So, flukes, we all know, are whale's tails. So, what's this book?
Well, the idea behind the book is that when you see flukes, you're not really seeing the whole picture. And I wanted to create a little story around the idea of a kid and his mom out on the water. And the kid says, "Look, Mom, a whale." And the mom says, "Well, that's not a whale." And kids love riddles like that. And the mom says, "That's just a whale's flukes." And so the rest of the book, the kid learns that a whale is made up of a lot more than just flukes.
When you do something like this, you have to put your head in a place that it doesn't normally live, because you have to be the kid to a big extent.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find
and
that?
The mom?
No, yeah, well, both of those. But did you find yourself able to look at it with the incredulity of a child?
Well, I work with kids a lot, and so I think that helps in being able to reflect that attitude. I love kids' attitude of excitement and discovery, and that's something that I really wanted to encourage in this book. And I should mention that actually there are two authors on this book. It's myself and Cheryl Cook, so I don't want to take complete credit for it.
So are you presenting this book anywhere? Are you're reading or are you doing a reading or or a presentation?
The most adjacent thing here
imminent.
Tomorrow is a program at the Mendenhall Valley Public Library. It's at 1:00. It's got a kids activity related to it, and I'll read the book. Everybody's welcome, of course, but aiming it kind of toward kids, primary grades or so. I'll be reading the book, showing some of the original illustrations, talking a little bit about it, and then we've got an activity, an art activity, that kids can do to create their own unique, distinctive whale flukes.
Now, you've been drawing pictures of nature for a long time, but I had a conversation quite a while ago with Ray Troll, and one of the things he said to me is kind of stuck in my mind. He said when he started trying to draw fish, he realized that he was going to have to learn a whole lot more about fish before he could actually draw one right. And did you find that? Is that something that you experienced as well?
Sure. And whales, I think, even have a bigger challenge in that it's really hard to find a good reference photo of a whale. I've seen whales a lot. We've all seen whales out in the water. We've seen the flukes and the fins, and sometimes if they breach, we can see more. But to get a sense of the actual shape of a humpback whale is a big challenge. Photographs from underwater, say from Hawaii, often big distortions in the shape of the whale because of the way the cameras work. And so that was an interesting challenge for me, is finding references to work with. I actually used a plastic model of a whale for a lot of the references in the book.
Was the plastic model accurate?
It is supposedly, yes, very accurate. Although whales are interesting, too. Humpbacks are interesting in that the shape changes a lot. Of course, they've got that huge throat pouch that billows out, and that can change. They'll lose a huge portion of their body weight every year when they migrate south and then come back. So the shape of a whale's body really changes.
So something of a challenge. And a children's book. Do you feel a kind of a responsibility to make sure that the book is right?
Yes, I do, particularly a book like this, because it really is a natural history-based book. And one of the biggest goals in this book we had was to inspire kids to look for the things they don't see. And so we wanted it to be accurate. So I tried to do a lot of research, had the book reviewed by people who know whales, really just tried to make it as true to life as possible. Although our knowledge about whales is always changing, so I'm sure that some things we say in here are going to be totally incorrect in a few years.
What other sources did you need to go to in order to get information to ensure the accuracy of the book?
Everything from books to scientific papers to experts in the field.
And when you did you contact some of these folks? Did you talk to them? And when you told them what you were doing, what were their reactions?
I think they enjoyed it. I think they enjoyed the chance to review something that wasn't a really dense technical scientific paper.
So you sent it around for people to actually to look at. Okay.
Yes.
Well, I have it in front of me, and I have to say that it is a beautiful book. The colors are just rich.
Thank you.
And, of course, your drawings are always so I'm looking right now at the one of the very last pictures, and it's the kid looking over the side of the boat. And once you told me that you didn't do faces, but you do faces better than you say.
Well, thank you. I had a really good model of a young friend of mine.
Well, he certainly looks like he's fascinated with what he's seeing here. So the illustrations are just marvelous. And everybody gets a chance to see this when you do a little show at the library. And again, what's the time on that?
1 o'clock tomorrow. That's Saturday at the Mendenhall Valley Public Library. And if you don't miss that and you want to come to another one, we're doing a book signing at Hearthside Books on November 1st for First Friday.
Excellent. Okay. So, and that's the downtown Hearthside.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay, so bring the kid along with the book and get it signed and all that sort of stuff, or sneak it in, get Kathy to sign it, and then slide it into some Christmas wrapping and hold on to it for a little longer. Okay. Thank you so much. It's an excellent piece, and I appreciate your coming down and kind of showing it off a little bit with us.
Thank you, Pat.
A little whale music to close this interview out.
On a fateful day in the month of May, I was sitting catching fish when a magic whale swam up to the rail and said, "Please make a wish." So I said, "Well, gee, I'd love to be like you, a giant whale." Next thing I knew, I was grayish blue and I had a two-ton tail. Sing a whale song. Sing a whale song. Sing a whale song. As the flounder said to the oyster bed, sing a whale song. With a mighty leap, I go down deep and swam out through the cove. Then a race to the top, did a belly flop, and down again I dove. From the Arctic to the Baltic to the far off Hebrides, like a submarine through the deep blue green, I swam the seven seas and sang a whale song. Sing a whale song. Sing a whale song. As the dogfish bark to the great white shark, sing a whale song. But there were some things I wish I could forget, like that garbage scow off of Curacao, or that oil.
Well, there are moments in the history of doing a radio show when really spectacular things happen, and that happens every once in a while when the Alaskan Brewery comes out with a new batch. It turns out that sitting in front of me right now is a glass of a curiously brown liquid, and Andy Klein, who everybody that is involved with KTOO will recognize his voice the minute he speaks, is here with several other people from the brewery. Darren Jensen is here, Tyler Lindquist, Marcos Morehouse, and Mike Dunleavy. Did I get everybody, I think? Yeah, that's the whole
crowd. You got everyone there, Pat, but just wanted to make clear that Marcos and Mike are actually here from Heritage Coffee, because this is a coffee brown ale you have in front of you, and so you'll be tasting the coffee of that. And these guys worked hand-in-hand with Tyler and Darren on making this great brew.
So now you all are bringing this out at the depot tonight, right?
Yeah, happening 5 o'clock, 5 to 7 tonight. There's a free tasting, and these guys will all be there to sort of coach people and do a bit of a tutored tasting as people are tasting it. Heritage is going to be bringing also one of the coffees that's used in this. There's two varieties of coffee in this beer, and they'll be bringing that as well, kind of doing a cupping and a tasting. It'll be some cupcakes.
Cupcakes are good. Cars cupcakes. Yeah, she's.
And so it'll be a great, really fun event happening from 5 to 7 tonight at the downtown depot. Yeah.
Okay, good. Well,
yeah.
Mike and Marcos, instruct me. I'm about to sip, so give me your best shot here.
Well, on this is the brewery brought over their malt, and we got to roast it in our roaster with coffee. And that's one part of getting the flavor in there for him. And we also did a cold brew of about 20 gallons of coffee for them to also go into this. And
explain a cold brew. Maybe not everybody knows what
It's coffee that's ground up into a filter bag, and it sits in the water overnight for 12 hours. It extracts all the coffee out, so you get the really concentrate, and it keeps it really clean, really nice tasting. They brought over nice, I believe, aerated water for us, and they did the magic from there. It was actually a really fun project, and I hope we could do this some more.
What the heck is aerated water?
It's actually de-aerated water.
Ah.
There's no oxygen.
Okay.
Oh, okay. How do you do that? Do I need to know?
It's just basically carbonated.
Oh,
okay. Like seltzer water.
Oh, okay. Okay, good. Okay. And then, Mike, what was your part of this whole operation?
I roasted all the coffee and the coffee beer for it, or in the coffee beer. We did the malt. It was kind of a group effort. We all decided what we needed to do and how we needed to do it. I pretty much stepped in and did it, but then it's pretty much a group thing from us at Heritage to do it then, and then they came over and we did the cold brew for them with that. So
yeah,
it's kind of a learning process. Yeah. Highly experimental across the
board. It was all new
board.
To all of us. It was the first, first time we ever did any of this.
Now, this is part of the Rough Draft series, right?
Yeah.
And can you explain a little bit about what the Rough Drafts are?
Rough Draft just means that it's only available on draft. And this is actually Rough Draft Limited, meaning it's only available in Alaska and on draft. So if folks want to get a Bronco pump, or if they have a kegerator, they can stop by the brewery and get a keg. Or if they go to one of the bars around town, they'll be carrying this. They'll be carrying this coffee brown ale.
Get a growler.
Yeah, or a growler.
growler.
Yeah, growlers at the brewery.
Well, since I own a growler, I may have to take advantage of this. It is really interesting.
Well, I know you are a coffee connoisseur. So what do you think about the coffee flavors?
Well,
in that beer?
I'm sitting here thinking that it really is totally different from the oatmeal stout, which is your other dark beer that's regularly around, and. I get this coffee thing, and when he said cold brew, I understand why it doesn't have much acid floating around in the back end of it, because it really is very light on the back palate.
And that's a real conscious decision that these guys wanted to have happen in the beer. Is that right, Darren?
Yeah, that's kind of the basis behind it. There's actually two different kinds of coffee that are in this brew, Brazilian and Ethiopian.
Ah, okay.
And so
Ethiopian Harar?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. So real high caffeine content.
Right.
Okay, so we're kind of speedballing here. Right?
But not super...
It gives you wings. Yeah.
But that's not a super aromatic coffee. So we kind of... the idea was to just kind of match that up with this style of beer, which is a brown ale.
Yeah.
And kind of extract some of those aromatics that like an Ethiopian coffee could extract, and without making it too acidic or dark or bitter.
Well, we're running really close to time here, but I want to talk about, tell me what a brown ale is. He turns the microphone to the guy next to him, right?
A little bit of caramel essence to it, so it's pretty smooth, not a lot of hops, although we did add some Simcoe earthy tones to it. So I recommend come down to the depot and try some.
So tasting starts at 5 o'clock at the depot tonight.
That's
and
right.
The depot's address is?
I don't know the address offhand, but it's downtown. It's
downtown.
Just a block up from the Red Dog and a
there
block down from the Alaskan.
Everybody knows where the block up from the Red Dog is. That's a typical Alaskan address. Anyway, thank you, guys. Thank you so much for bringing the beer down, and thanks so much for opening it up for everybody else.
Thank you.
See you about 5 tonight.
Cheers.
You're in tune with KTOO Juneau. We broadcast on translators K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley in Auk Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K201 AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. And support for national programming on KTOO comes to you from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And thank you very much, listeners like you. By the way, we're in the midst of our quiet drive right now, so if you'd like to call up and pledge, you just go online. The forms are all right there. Just go to ktoo.org and follow the links. So we've been talking to a bunch of wonderful folks today and tonight. Be sure you think about dropping up to the campus about 7 o'clock after you've had a beer downtown. Swing in and meet Bill Morrison, the co-author of Sinking the Princess Sophia, Taking the North Down With Her, as he talks about that event back in 1918 and its importance to Alaska and the Yukon Territory. Thank you very much for listening to Juneau Afternoon today. Stay tuned.
We don't have horns. You know, we're not from another planet. And we have our own life experiences, and we see things in a certain way.
Tea Party activists regroup after a failed political bid to defund the new health care law.
For Friday, October 18th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Coming up, our weekly political commentators on what's next for Republicans and Democrats headed to the bargaining table.
And President Obama nominates a new chief of Homeland Security. He's former Defense Department lawyer Jay Johnson.
I am a New Yorker, and I was present in Manhattan on 9/11, which happens to be my birthday. I wandered the streets of New York that day and wondered, what can I do?
And a middle schooler deported to Kosovo is at the center of a roiling immigration debate in France.
Those stories this hour, but first, these headlines.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. Transit workers' strike has snarled the evening commute in the San